Hello, everybody. Welcome to Tea Time History Chat Live with me, Philippa Lacey Brawl. Thank you for joining me if you're joining me live. I am attempting to stream to Instagram as well. There we go. Hello, everyone. I can see some of you joining me already. Today, I thought, let's go through, for laughs, why not? We're going to go through the badges and mottos of Henry VIII's queens today as a theme for today. But I've also got other stuff that I wanted to talk to you about as well. Last week, we talked about the final days of Elizabeth I because we were in the run-up to the anniversary of her death, which was on the 24th. We also talked about two other anniversaries last week in history. That was the murder of Edward, who became known as Edward the Martyr, at the gates of Corfe Castle. And we also talked about the execution of Thomas Cranmer. So if you missed that and you want to go back, then obviously after this, I always leave all the Tea Time lives up except for the one where I except for the one where someone riled me. That one did go. But anyway, they're all there for you to go back and have a look at. Most of the stuff's evergreen, I think. So yeah, good morning. I can see Deborah, Marianne, Emma, Linda, Catherine, Costas. Welcome. I've forgotten to put my little banner on. There we are. Keep everyone informed as to what we're doing. And Diane, hi, good morning. Lots of you over there in America, so it's all morning for you. So I don't know how early in the morning. Don't know if I'm supposed to speak quietly or if you want me to be energetic to help you wake up. I do that. I put on podcasts that are energetic to help me get up in the morning. But there you go. So I am streaming live on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. Yeah, you can support me with badges on Instagram, I believe, super chats on YouTube. And if you put a super chat in, you are obviously guaranteed that I will read you out. And also, I think it's stars on Facebook. So, Costas asking about the Stuarts event. I will talk about that in a moment, actually. It went very well. Thank you. So Deborah, 11 a.m. on the East Coast. Okay, you should be awake by now, shouldn't you? So you can support me in that way. But of course, my favorite way for you to support me, because I can give you a lot more back, is on my Patreon, patreon.com/British History. And I will be asking later today for some questions in my Patreon for Estelle Peronc, because I'm going to be interviewing her in a couple of weeks' time about her new book about Anne Boleyn and her time in France. So if you want to put questions to Estelle and you are a patron, look out for that post. If you're not a patron, that's fine. Come along, have a look at patreon.com/British History. Got all the benefits listed there, and you can decide if it's for you or not. And if it is, then you can jump in and put your questions to Estelle as well. The interview I did with Nathan Armin is now available on YouTube, but there is a longer, an extended ad-free version, which is available in Patreon. So I think the one on YouTube is about an hour and 10, can't quite remember actually, and the one in Patreon is near enough 2 hours. The one just on YouTube is gold. I don't think there's anything about Henry the Seventh that Nathan Armin doesn't know, and there's so much about Henry the Seventh that surprised me in that interview, but also the Tudor family. I've put in the trailer for it a little soundbite of me actually asking about Owen Tudor, the uncle. There was an uncle called Owen Tudor of Henry the Seventh. And Linda says Patreon is well worth it. Thank you so much. Hi, Becky. Hi, a woman. Smiley face. Marianne, welcome. And Brianna. Hi. Oh, Melissa's here as well. Hi. Oh, Marianne says the Nathan interview was great. I so enjoyed it. I'm not sure whether he knew we were going to take 2 hours, but there was just so much. He would say something and I'd be like, oh, I want to know more about that. In the Patreon extended version, I got him to speak some Welsh, which was fascinating. And we delved into his relationships with his mother, his wife, his son, Henry, obviously, who had become Henry VIII. So if you're interested in that and you join Patreon, that interview is available in there. But there is, of course, the free version available on YouTube. And if you want to support me with Super Chats, you can do that there. We looked at things like how Welsh was Henry the Tudor. I wanted to know how Henry the Tudor. What am I on about? How Welsh was Henry Tudor? Just what kind of man he was as a child, as a youth, as an adult, when he decided to make a bid for the English throne, which I hadn't realized was quite as early as it was. Melissa is also saying that the Nathan video was excellent. Thank you so much. And Beverly and Marianne. And so everyone's enjoyed it. I'm really glad. I thought you would, because he is so knowledgeable. It's packed. It's such an interesting story as well. And Henry VII is so, I think he's overshadowed by Henry VIII and Elizabeth I. And actually, his story is very compelling and real. He's so human. He goes through, we'd have him in counseling these days. He goes through so much as a child, and then, you know, he's separated from his mother, and he's caught up in wars, and he has to go into exile, and then he's sort of put in line for the throne, and what he's got to do is come back and raise an army and go on the battlefield, and then of course he marries and Elizabeth of York, and that's a happy union, and they have children, and then of course they lose children along the way as well, but they lose their eldest Arthur, who actually I'll be talking about a little bit today with talking about Catherine of Aragon, and then he loses his wife Elizabeth of York, because they basically try and have more children, and she dies with the next birth. That is such tragedy to deal with, and we talk about this in the interview with Nathan. Melissa says she's going to watch it again. Brianna is looking forward to the interview with Estelle. Oh, really enjoying being a Patreon member. Thank you very much, Brianna. Thank you. Well, I'm trying to, you know, give you access to things that it's just, you know, it's not it's cool. You know, it's fun, isn't it? It's so good. And to have access to these historians as well. Ali says Nathan is so passionate and yet sensible. Yes. I asked him about beer. Did you see that bit as well? But a great talk with him. Linda says he also tells what he also tells us when he doesn't know a thing. Is that what you're getting at, Linda? Yeah, if he doesn't know something, he'll say, I don't know. And that's, as Linda says, that's something to really appreciate in historians. Gareth Russell is the same. If he doesn't know, he's not going to make it up and pretend he knows. These are such well-read people. So they do so much research that if they don't know, then actually what happens is, like with me asking about Owen Tudor, the uncle, and whether or not there were any potential links between him, because he was a monk at Westminster Abbey, and Elizabeth Woodville, potentially. I don't know. I don't know if the dates match up. I've no idea. But Nathan's like, oh, I don't know. That's interesting. That's a true historian. They're not them and their ideas, or them and their research are not one and the same thing. They can add to it, alter it, question it. You know, it's brilliant. Melissa says Nathan is so interesting to listen to. His subject matter tends towards the unique. He's got so into, obviously his next book is on Henry VII, and it is a biography of Henry VII up to becoming king. So the bit that less people, or is less covered. The Winter King, actually, by Thomas Penn, is a really good book on Henry VII as well. I would recommend that. I'd love to interview Thomas Penn, actually. Marianne says she's just finished The Palace by Gareth. He is an awesome writer. And he puts so much information in, and yet it is so readable. And I think Nathan is like that as well. So, yeah, really, really good. So if you want access to the longer version, where we talk relationships and Wales, then go over to Patreon. Or there's a substantially good, a substantial and very good interview with him on YouTube and on the podcast as well, which I must give a shout out to anyone who's listening on the podcast, because if you do miss these lives, you can listen back on the podcast, and all the historian interviews are on the podcast as well. It's British History, which I realise now is actually difficult if you just type that into your search engine on your whichever podcast you use, because there's lots on British history and it'll bring up all of them. So if you look for the one with my face on and a flag behind me, that's the one you're looking for. Linda says Nathan's next book might be a possibility for book club. Yes, I think maybe it is. Although there's so many. I'll take a little break, have a sip of my tea. Has everyone got their drinks with them? So I have interviewed another historian this morning, Sharon Bennett Connolly, and it was really fun. It was so interesting. Sharon has written medieval women's history back in. So she has done books about the women of the conquest. She's done a particular book on Nicola de la Haye, who was a woman sheriff in the time of King John. In fact, he makes a sheriff on his deathbed. And she's written a book on women of the anarchy, basically the two Matildas, so Empress Matilda and Queen Matilda, who was King Stephen's wife. And I've interviewed her this morning. Excuse me, my voice is going a little bit. And so that part, all about the anarchy, will be available on YouTube in May. And the extended version for patrons, we went into women of the Magna Carta, and also she answered your questions as well. So I did that this morning. That will be out in May. April's interview is with Kate Clements, who is the curator of the Churchill War Rooms. I know I spoke about that just after my visit there. And that will be available in April. So again, patrons as well, you get it the week before everyone else. So there you go. There's lots of things, I think, good perks being patron. It does give me the opportunity to give you a lot back. But anyway, we're here today. I must give a shout out there to Jennifer, Layla, Marcy and Alberta, who've all become, who are the newest members of Patreon. Also, I must give a shout out to Linda, who is, she's just, you're such a support. And can I point out that behind me, if you're watching this, on my shelf behind me, I actually have two, what do you call them, Linda? My nanny used to call them samplers, is that correct? Like embroidered Tudor rose behind me. And actually you can't see because there's a card in front of it, but there's a Anne Boleyn necklace B behind me on the shelf. So those are both Linda's work. But you're a great supporter, you've been on tour with me a couple of times and a member of my Patreon. And you also do the give a little more tier cross stitch. There you go. Can you tell I disappointed my nana, but I never managed it. My eyesight is too crap, to be honest as well. If I did that, I think I would really send it to the dogs. But and you do the give a little more help, give a little more tier. So I'm very grateful to that. So Costas, sorry, you asked about the Stuarts event on the weekend. It was brilliant. Thank you so much for asking. We had six talks, one of which was actually myself talking about the gunpowder plot. Well, actually the roll up to, that's not the phrase I'm looking for, is it? The build up to the gunpowder plot, all the oppression and the false promises given to English Catholics, going right back really to the split with Rome in the beginning and how that then creates not just a ideological split, but you're looking at a loyalties split. Because if you're loyal to the Pope, you're loyal to a foreign power, when actually your domestic king is saying, you need to follow me. And anyway, so that rolls on, and of course, into Elizabeth's, I know you've got Edward's and Mary's reign, and I went into that, and then you go into Elizabeth's reign, and Elizabeth isn't even recognised as the rightful queen by Catholic Europe because of her father's marriage to Anne Boleyn, and obviously it being the second one, which I'm going to go into when we do get onto badges and mottos. So there's that. Sorry, there's Gareth Russell's talk on Anna of Denmark. She is a character, and Gareth, she has her own chapter in The Palace. So any of you who've read Gareth Russell's book, The Palace, will know she has her own chapter, and rightfully so. We had Katie, whose book behind me is Abandoned London, there. Katie Wignall, she talked about the Great Fire of London, gave us a virtual walking tour of London. Andrea Zuvich talked about the tenuous power of beauty, so basically mistresses at the Stuart court, how it worked for some and really didn't work for others. So it's me, Gareth. Oh, and Julian Humphreys talked about the escape. Sorry, all of you have watched this already, you might, but I'll give you in the moment, in fact, rolling across the screen as well, I've put where you can get these talks. If you missed the Online History Festival, you can still get the bundle of these talks and of the other history festivals that have happened in the past. I'll give you that information in a second. So we have Julian Humphreys talking about the six-week escape of Charles II after the Battle of Worcester. So it's interesting because also, when we're talking about the Republic, the Cromwellian sort of, well, it wasn't him from the very beginning as leader, but anyway, that 11-year period where we had no monarchy, that is almost, well, we discussed this in the Q&A, the live Q&A, it was almost a blip, or it's almost seen as a blip if you look back. So, which it wasn't, but if Charles II had been captured, he would have been executed. And there wouldn't have been the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 the same way as it did happen. And that escape was really quite, it's movie worthy. Walking into somewhere, you know, as if nothing's a problem, nothing's wrong, because you can't draw attention to yourself. So quite incredible. And then Professor Alice Hunt joined us to talk about the Republic and Cromwell. So that was cool. And I will be interviewing Alice. She has a new book out about the Republic. I think it's just called Republic, actually. She will have a new book out in September. So I will be interviewing her too. So again, another person you can put your questions to if you're a member of my Patreon. The next online history festival is already available to buy if you want. It's on the Victorians this time. I'm currently putting together the speaker lineup. I already know Aleary Lynn is going to be talking to us about Victorian corsetry and underwear. So, and I do have a few that I'm just, other speakers that I am waiting for just confirmation on. But it's going to be great. It's always great. So you can already get your tickets for that. There's some early bird ones available. And if you're a member of my Patreon, guess what? You get a discount on those tickets as well. So it's all good. And that's going to be taking place the 15th till the 17th of November. So shall we get on to today's topic? Anyone who's come into this and doesn't know me, this is when I get comments that go, she took 20 minutes until she started talking about what she was supposed to be talking about. But here we go. Oh. Laurie says she really enjoyed Alice's talk on Cromwell and Interregnum, excuse me, very informative. Yes, I really enjoyed it. She's so lovely. I'd never met her before, but the live Q&A, we had a lot of questions about the interregnum and really, really interesting answers. Marianne, late but here. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And Becky said the festival was great. Thank you so much. Okay, so shall we, at 19 minutes and 26 seconds in, get into Henry VIII's wives? Badges and mottos. Let's do it. Oh, let's have a sip of my tea. Otherwise, my voice is going to go. So, I actually have some slides for you. Sorry if you're listening on the podcast. So, what I have done is put up a slide of the Queen. This is for people on the podcast who won't be able to see this, but a picture of the Queen, her badge, and her motto. So the first queen, of course, of Henry VIII is Catherine of Aragon. Of course, she was destined to be Queen of England before, because she was betrothed at the age of 3 to Henry VIII's eldest brother, Arthur Tudor. And in fact, she did, of course, marry Arthur Tudor, but unfortunately, he died 6 months into the marriage. He died in April, 1502. His death, of course, precipitated Elizabeth of York becoming pregnant for another time at the age of 36. And that was the pregnancy that unfortunately led to her death and Henry VII going into mourning. But when Arthur Tudor died, Catherine of Aragon didn't know what was going to happen to her. Her future was very it was unsettled. It was uncertain. The second half of her marriage portion hadn't been paid, and her father and her father-in-law, Henry VII, got into, so Ferdinand of Aragon, Henry VII, got into kind of protracted, drawn-out arguments as to what should happen to Catherine. But she stayed in England the entire time. So once she came to England, she never actually left. Now, when Henry VIII comes to the throne, when his father dies, he's just short of his 18th birthday. And he thinks that it would be a great idea to show how mature he is. And a great way to do that is to get married. Catherine of Aragon is who he chooses. And he chooses one of his first decisions as king, if not the first decision as king, independent decision. She's got a lot going for her. She's already in the country. He already knows her. In fact, Henry walked her down the aisle at her wedding to his brother Arthur. And she's a foreign princess. So immediately, Henry has got an alliance there with the Catholic kings. So a powerful alliance. And it elevates his position. She's from a very, you know, established European royal family. He's from a not so established one. And it raises his sort of worth, I suppose. Not that I reckon he would have admitted to that. And as queen, she adopts the motto humble and loyal. And I don't think you could argue against her deliverance of this as her motto, humble and loyal. Maybe not actually humble, definitely loyal. Yeah, but you could interpret it as stubborn, because when it comes to Henry's great matter, of course, when they haven't got a son between them who can inherit, and she's gone through the menopause, so she's not going to have any more children. You know, she stays in her position. Perhaps she thinks she's protecting Mary. Turns out it's obviously the opposite. But anyway, that's in the future at this point. So for her badge, she chooses the pomegranate, which is a symbol of, it's a Christian symbol of Christ's resurrection. The seeds, it's slashed open so that you can see the seeds. And of course, that is a very obvious, when you know it, linked to, you know, fertility. There's going to be lots of children from this marriage. It's a quite direct promise of a nursery full of good Christian children. And then, of course, the crown above. Melissa says, did she have a motto as Princess of Wales? I don't know whether mottos were only adopted once they became queen. Oh, Linda asked the same question. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know if they had their own mottos and they changed them, or they had them at all before they were queen. That I would have to ask somebody who's more who's an expert on sort of heraldry and all the stuff that goes with that. Now, of course, Catherine's offspring did turn out to be Christian, very pious in Mary the First. And the marriage had got off to a good start. On New Year's Day 1511, Catherine did give birth to a boy, and his name was he was named Henry after his father. But unfortunately, he died on the 22nd of February. And then she had multiple pregnancies, but only one child, obviously, we know, who survived to adulthood, Mary the First. So there were two decades of marriage. I think, I don't know if it's missed sometimes, maybe if you're not very, very, very into your Tudor history, I think it can be missed just how long Henry's first marriage was. But it broke down, of course. She didn't help herself by really, really not complying with what could be argued as sensibly sort of moving out the way. Other queens had done it, and allowing Henry to try with a second wife to have sons. But anyway, she didn't do that. And Henry had increasingly believed that he'd attracted God's wrath by marrying his brother's widow, and that is why their son had died. That is why Catherine couldn't give birth to a live son, or one, a son that would survive, and that was God's judgment on them. And of course, he'd got his eye on someone else. Now, someone did request, who was it? Juju requested that this isn't 70% about Anne Boleyn, because that's what tends to happen. Well, no, I get my Anne Boleyn fix running the Anne Boleyn tour every year. We've got two actually this year. And I will mention that the Anne Boleyn tour 2025 will be on sale really soon. I'm going to pick a date actually, I'm going to pick a date after this or tomorrow. So I'm going to look at it and we're going to get it on sale really soon. I know there's a lot of you waiting to get booked onto that. So I will get onto that really soon. If you're a member of my Patreon, you get to book on 7 days before it goes on general release. So you get to secure your place, secure your room upgrades if you want them, all of that kind of thing. Marianne says Catherine did try to fulfill that objective. Yeah, I think she did. I think it might be linked to Melissa's point. Her mother was a warrior queen. It makes more sense that she wouldn't step aside. Yeah, there's a pragmatism that's easy to talk of if you're not in that situation, I think. But I know Henry had mistresses. There's nothing unusual about that at this time. But yeah. And who, maybe Henry had not shown any signs that he was going to actually disinherit his daughter. From that point of view, that's very bizarre. He gets rid of his only heir. It delegitimizes his only heir before he's got another one. Melissa says Henry was looking at the wrong biblical law. He was actually commanded to marry his brother's widow. Pays your money, takes your choice. Yeah. Of course, yeah. He interpreted it as he wanted. But I also don't want to disregard how much he may well have believed that in an age where, you know, God's talking to you through what happens to you. And so, yeah, we'll never know. It was in Henry's brain. We don't know how much was true belief and how much was it was useful to him. It was, he went with it because it served his purpose. But then, of course, we get Anne Berlin, and she or I should say, sorry, if you're watching on Instagram, so I can't see your comments. So if you want to come in and see me over on YouTube or Facebook, please do. It's youtube.com/British History. And on Facebook, I'm British History Tours. Okay, sorry, little interlude. So yes, yeah, so then we obviously get on to Anne Boleyn. She first appeared at court, in 1522. And you know, over that time, after Anne's at court, but during that time of her sort of being on the scene, this is, you know, Henry's getting more and more convinced that he's done something wrong anyway. And certainly he's not got a male heir, and he's not going to get one through his wife, Catherine of Aragon. Yeah, Melissa says the one he used applied to a living brother. Yeah, I think that the Leviticus, chapter. So of course Henry sought an annulment, and Rome was not going to comply. What Henry's great matter, as it became known, centered on his assertion of, you know, he'd slept with his late brother's wife, but there had been a dispensation also by Pope Julius II at the time of his marriage, so he had actually got a papal dispensation. But they decided no, that had been based on mistruths, and it was invalid. So in Henry's mind, the logical conclusion was his marriage had never been valid, never happened, needed to be annulled and start again. And this is something you see with Henry. He wants to obliterate things that no longer suit him. His marriages that the end are all dissolved, they're annulled. People that he doesn't want around are destroyed, any memories of them wiped. And you know, there's something going on there. But yeah, with his great matter, there's a petition sent to Pope Clement VII, which is, I've been to Rome. I went to Rome to see it, how intrigued I was with it. I mean, it's got a thinly veiled threat of extreme measures. Well, the Pope at this point is busy with other stuff. Rome has been sacked. He has been taken prisoner. Basically now answerable to Catherine of Aragon's nephew, Charles V, was it? There's a much bigger story of what is happening in Rome at the time that Henry is buzzing around the Pope's ear about wanting to basically get rid of his first wife. There's a whole story there, and I'm hoping actually to get somebody in to interview about that, because it's fascinating, because we're looking at it from a sort of Anglo-centric point of view, but the Roman point of view is it'll get it sorted. It'll sort of sort itself out. How ridiculous. Laurie says, if Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon would have had a living son, he would never have thought of the theory that God didn't approve his marriage. Yes, the fact that they didn't have a son was the proof, if you like, that God didn't approve of the marriage. So it's, yeah, if there had been one, that would have been fine. There wasn't. Therefore, that was the proof that God didn't like the marriage. Yeah, Marianne, he just covers his ears, fingers in his ears, la, 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 didn't happen. Beverly, he conveniently forgot that he'd slept with Anne's sister Mary when he was trying to get a divorce. Costas, Henry, actions of a sociopath. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Melissa, yes, I did. I went all the way to Rome to see it. And Rome is one of my, I want to go to Rome again, actually. I haven't been for a few years, but it's one of my favorite places. And I was managing to go for a year pretty much at one point. Diane says Henry is the do-over king. Yeah. So that petition was sent to the Vatican in 1530, but it was unsuccessful for the reasons I've sort of outlined there. And it was about 3 years after that that Henry finally married Anne without ever sort of settling what was happening about his first marriage with the church in Rome. And of course, he decides that he doesn't need to go to the Pope for intercedence with God about what he thinks he should or shouldn't do, because he's the anointed king, and you know, and Anne has a role in getting him to believe in putting this idea forward to him that he takes on, that actually God has anointed him, and so he doesn't need the Pope to intercede. He can talk to God himself. So he obviously, as we know, splits with Rome in this decisive split and puts himself as head of the church in England. Marianne asks, was the thought of Henry Fitzroy ever considered? So there is some evidence that potentially, so his daughter Mary, obviously by this point illegitimate, but she let me go back a bit. When their children, Catherine and Mary and Henry Fitzroy, are similar ish in age, she is given the title or the role and she of head of the Earl of the Marches, I think. She goes to Ludlow Castle anyway. She's never invested as the Princess of Wales, but it's kind of heavily implied that that's her role. Henry Fitzroy is sent to the northern border, the border with Scotland, in a similar role. He's obviously made a duke. So is it Duke of Richmond, isn't he made? So of course he dies in 1536, a couple of months after Anne Boleyn is executed. So who knows? I wouldn't be surprised if there was some thought to it, but I think it would have been a last resort if he'd have survived and Henry didn't have any more sons. We're in the sort of what-if-ery camp, but he was certainly given roles, titles, so prominence as well. Melissa, if we give him the tiniest bit of grace, he must have been absolutely bewildered about why he couldn't have a living son. I think so. He's surrounded by, you know, other courtiers having children left, right and centre. Some couples seem to find it really easy. Some couples are not finding it easy at all. He's one of four surviving, well, not by the time he's king, but, you know, four children who got to, who had or do get to adulthood, and more babies had been born and had lived for maybe a little while or into their early years. So yeah, I think he probably was bewildered. There was a lot of soul searching. How on earth is he not having a living son? How? What has he done to offend God so much? So he is looking for a reason. I mean, you know, it's not killing innocents or anything like that, obviously. So it must be something else. So there you go. I think these arguments, these justifications allow for cherry picking somewhat. Do you agree? Anne adopts so they get married. His marriage to Catherine of Aragon is never officially annulled in terms of sort of Rome. Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, as we spoke about last week, he annuls Catherine of Aragon's marriage. And if you're interested in how that then transpires for him later on in Mary the First reign, then go back and watch last week. Anne adopts the motto, the most happy. And her badge is a crowned falcon, famously a crowned falcon. Now it's, there's so many, what, I was going to say there's so many being found, but no, you know, you've got one that was found at auction that was identified and has become quite famous. But there are quite a few in the Great Hall of Hampton Court. If you know where to look, you can still see them. But anyway, the crown falcon, it's holding a scepter and it's stood on a wood stock, which has, it's sort of an established royal badge. It alludes to previous barrenness, the barrenness, as Henry saw it, of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. You have the white and red roses coming out of the wood stump, the wood stock, which represents, of course, children of the York, which would be the United York and Lancaster family, which, of course, the Queen's going to provide for him. And the crown is interesting because it is it's the imperial crown, not a kingly one, because now Henry is elevated even higher than that of a king. He is now sort of emperor in his own kingdom, if you like. Anne obviously gave birth to the couple's, she gave birth to the couple's first child in September 1533, a girl, Elizabeth, but Anne never gave birth to another living child, although there were, I think, at least two more pregnancies that we know of. She suffered her final miscarriage on the 28th of January, 1536. That's the same day that Catherine of Aragon was actually laid to rest in Peterborough Abbey. Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn, they die in 1536. They die within months of each other. And Anne's downfall when it came was rapid and it was brutal. And I've done a whole series on the downfall of Anne Boleyn. Obviously, if you want to come and come with us to explore the story in person, along with Gareth Russell, our tour historian, and other historians who join us along the way, then you can do that on the Anne Boleyn tour, which we'll be doing in May 2025, the 16th till the 20th. We cover the 19th of May. So we go to the Tower of London on the day that Anne was executed. And like I said earlier, the details of that will be released shortly. What's really shocking, I think, about one of the things that's shocking about Anne's story is how long Henry took to marry her. And then obviously they did have this sort of three, four year period of being married. And then her fall is so rapid. He'd moved heaven and earth to be with her. And yet, on the downfall of Anne, it takes him no time at all to be betrothed to his next wife, Jane Seymour. Literally, the month wasn't over. Anne was executed on the 19th of May. And by the end of the month, Henry was betrothed, was married to Jane Seymour. He married her on the 30th of May, so 11 days after Anne's execution. And maybe she learned from the plights of her predecessors. I don't know. I think Jane has been given virtues that I'm not convinced she earned. I don't think she was in that. Had she lived for longer, we would have perhaps seen more of her character, more of her personality. She chooses the motto, bound to obey and serve, which she does do for Henry. She obviously gives birth to his only son, his longed for son, Edward, at Hampton Court Palace. And unfortunately, she dies from a postpartum infection about 12 days later. So had she have survived and been the mother of the heir, who knows what kind of personality she may have had and developed. So yes, so bound to obey and serve. Her badge again suggests the forthcoming of Tudor heirs. You've got the white and red, they're just like flowers, but presumably they're supposed to be roses. I always think emblems and mottos and badges are quite funny, especially when they draw animals. These aren't too bad, but look at some of the lions. They're incredible. And you've got a crowned phoenix rising from a castle. You can see the flames underneath. So, you know, this idea of rebirth and starting again must have appealed to him, to Jane as and Henry. But obviously it's short. Her survival is short as queen. Marianne says, did they ever look at environmental elements, lead, water, etc.? I did an interview with Leslie Smith about sex in the Tudors. Well, I think I called it Sex in Tudor England. I don't know. Have a look back. It's not far back. I don't remember if they were talking about lead. But their understanding of sort of gynecological issues were quite rudimentary. And I think the further up the social scale you got, the less, ironically, the less good the care was, because you would have male doctors or whatever who aren't allowed to see you. In fact, when, you know, when Jane's giving birth, when any of the queens giving birth, it's a female-only environment, which, you know, I don't know. I mean, you've got things like when they give birth, they've been in a room with no air, little light for, it's like a cocoon. They make a cocoon, which sounds lovely, but they're in there for a long time and it can't have been very healthy. I think there's probably a lot of different things that could be looked into, but it'll all be theory because we can't examine. We're not there. If you see what I mean. So with Jane gone, Henry is without a wife. For the first time, he's without a wife or a wife in waiting. And this gives rise to Cromwell coming in and saying, you know, sir, maybe a political match this time, maybe a foreign princess, remembering that Anne and Jane are both English. Maybe we should go abroad, get an alliance created. But now we need someone who's not aligned with the Pope. So we'll go and speak to the Duke of Cleves. And Hans Holbein is sent over to paint a picture of the Duke of Cleves' sister. I think both sisters, actually. This is the picture of Anne or Anna. And we're led to believe that when they meet, their first meeting, New Year's Day 1540, in their first meeting, Henry comes in disguise, and it must have, and Anna is supposed to, you know, recognize her true love. It sounds, why is it supposed to be true love is one of my questions. Someone you've never met, he's on his fourth marriage. You don't even share the same language. And anyway, so she's supposed to just magically know who he is, even though he's in disguise, and even though she's never actually seen him before. And he goes and kisses her, and she is, in my opinion, rightfully shocked. We're supposed to believe that this is crunch time for Henry. He just, from this point on, he thinks the marriage is not one that he wants to be part of. However, the legal factors are all in motion already, and he does have to marry Anna of Cleves, despite asking Cromwell to get him out of the marriage. He doesn't manage it. So, and that doesn't end well for Cromwell. But Anna, as her motto is, chooses God send me well to keep, which was also inscribed on her wedding ring, and her badge This is actually the golden escarbuncle, which is the coat of arms of Cleves. So that is the one that you will see on her tomb, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, I've got an interview with Heather Darcy about her research into the Cleves match, and it's about why it really fell down, why it failed, and it seems far more of a reason to me. If you want to watch that interview, I will put the links in the show notes so that you can go and watch it or listen to it on the podcast. But it does seem a more plausible rationale. There's basically political factors in play, and alliances, and there's lots going on in Europe, which Heather goes into in great detail in our interview. If you don't like the sound of birds, maybe don't watch it, because her birds were in the other room, believe it or not, with the door closed, and were crying out for their mom. So some people love the birds, some people found it really distracting. But yeah, and she's got a great book out there, as Linda says as well. So that marriage again is annulled. And Henry then turns into just, you know, the most wonderful host. She does do really well out of the settlement. I think, again, she's credited, a bit like Jane, with more, I think with hindsight, she's credited with more control of the situation than she actually had. I think she was pragmatic, but I'm not sure how much choice she actually had. She actually had in that situation anyway. That's not to take away from her clear intelligence that she had as a woman. She seems to have been very well liked, both at court and her own households. She would visit court, play cards with the king. She learns English, and you know, he refers to her as his sister. She has a position at court in terms of, you know, sort of the hierarchy, and they seem to get on very, very well for the rest of the time. But Henry again is on the marriage market, but it's okay, because what he's done is he's reverted to type, and he's already had his eye on one of Anna's ladies in waiting, of course, the very young Catherine Howard, wife number 5. She's around about 30 years younger than Henry. And like I said, she'd served as a maid of honour in Anna of Cleves' household, so he'd already had sight of her. And she was a cousin of Anne Boleyn. She's fun. She's youthful. I think Henry thinks he is still younger and more attractive than he actually is. So he thinks this is a great idea. I mean, he seems very, very taken with Catherine. I did an interview with Gareth Russell. Actually, there's loads of interviews linked to this topic today. I did a interview with Gareth Russell where I asked him to questions around comparing and contrasting the downfalls of Anne Boleyn, and Catherine Howard. And by doing that, you can learn more about each one, how Henry's role in each of them as well. He was cut up. He was really upset when Catherine Howard looked to betrayed him. But her motto was no other will than his. Not sure who he was in this case, but her badge is So that was it. So Henry called Catherine his blushing rose without a thorn. And if you look at the badge, you've got the red and the white, of course, of the Tudor rose, which looks more like a Tudor rose now. And the there is no thorn on the stem. And of course, it's crowned. So, and I do think out of all of Henry's wives, Catherine Howard is the one who wounded him the most. He's out of control with Catherine Howard in that it's not him who brings about her downfall as a plan, whereas I would argue that that certainly happens with Anne. And again, if you want to check that interview out with Gareth Russell, that was a really, really interesting discussion. Catherine was, we're not sure of her birthday, but maybe in her early 20s when she's beheaded at the Tower of London. So same place, of course, as her cousin Anne Boleyn, buried in St. Peter ad Vincula, which is also where Anne Boleyn rests. So wife number five. And he has, this is how he gets a reputation as a wife killer, of course. So wife number six, Catherine Parr. So thought of as the sensible one. She's still young. I can't remember how old she is when she marries Henry, but he's her third husband. She is his sixth wife. And of course we're told in the school rhyme that she survived. Well, okay, we'll go into that. She was a goddaughter of Catherine of Aragon, who she's named after. And she adopted the motto to be useful in all that I do. And I think she did live up to this, because not only was she's sort of putting up with Henry in his ill health. He's got leg ulcers. He's very, very, probably obese. I was going to say overweight, but he's not getting around very well. He probably smells because of his infections in his legs. Not a very pleasant thought. But she also challenges him intellectually, and indeed that almost gets her arrested. It gets her into trouble. She is a reformer. She is a Protestant as well, as we, that wasn't the term used then, but that's her inclination. And she could have gone the same way as Anne and as Catherine Howard. She's almost arrested, but she does manage to get to Henry first and explain to him that when she is talking about sort of reform doctrine, what she's doing is wanting to gain knowledge, his knowledge. She wants to talk to him about it because he is so, you know, so superior, so knowledgeable, that she wants his take on things. And that it's a distraction, of course, from his ailments. And she survives. She survives. Her badge is a crowned maiden coming out of a Tudor rose. Tudor rose choice is obvious, I suppose. But the crowned maiden, was long associated with the Parr family, crowned obviously because she is queen. And the maiden it's purity and virtue. So despite this being her third marriage, she didn't have any children by any of her marriages before or with Henry. It's just interesting how she's using it. It is a Parr badge, but she's using this maiden badge despite that sort of thing. Now, she outlived Henry, so she did survive, but she only outlived him by 18 months. Of course, Henry gets, when Henry dies, she, with with questionable haste, marries the uncle to the new king. So his name is Thomas Seymour, probably already know. He's uncle to the new king, Edward VI, because his sister was Jane Seymour. And Catherine Parr marries him very quickly. It is an outrage with everyone at the time, but they had been sort of wishing to perhaps get married before Henry had his eye on Catherine. And she became pregnant for the first time in her life at the age, I think she was 36. I'm not sure, I haven't written that down. And so her fourth marriage, her first pregnancy, and she gives birth to a baby girl. She gives birth at Sudley Castle in Gloucestershire, excuse me. But she dies a few days later from complications. That baby was a baby girl called Mary, who later goes into the wardship of Charles Brandon's widow, Catherine. Oh, her name has escaped me. Catherine, someone will let me know in a minute. But she did not want that hassle. But anyway, that's another story. So Catherine dies at Sudley Castle. So actually, the one that survives is Anna of Cleves. She's the one who really survives. She lives through the reigns of Edward VI, Mary I. She dies just before Elizabeth comes to the throne. And she is the only one of Henry and his wives to be buried in Westminster Abbey. So if I go back to Anna's slide, this emblem is the one that you will see on her tomb in Westminster Abbey. It's to the right of the high altar. It's also the one you'll see on a panel, which was found and identified. I think Jonathan Foyle was involved. Well, he was involved. I'm not sure who else was involved. And that can be seen at Hever Castle, which was one of the castles, which one of the properties which Anna got in the settlement. And has been work done by Simon Thurley has shown that she was there a lot more than had originally been thought, so much so that the gallery, which until a couple of years ago, well, until Simon Thurley's work had been attributed to Thomas Boleyn, Anne Boleyn's father, actually it was Anna of Cleves who had it built there at Hever Castle. So she was there a lot longer, which gives tantalizing theory that Elizabeth I maybe visited. It's her mother's childhood home. Anna, who is, who she is, does have a good relationship, lives there, is there quite often. Elizabeth goes to Penshurst Place, which is close by, where the sister of her favourite Robert Dudley lives. So it's very tantalising to think that Elizabeth went to Hever Castle, but there's no actually documentary evidence of it surviving. But anyway, it seems like it could be possible, highly possible. But Anna of Cleves is buried in Westminster Abbey. Henry is buried in St. George's Chapel, Windsor, alongside Jane Seymour. There's a whole video that I did, one of my first ever lives, which is about where Henry VIII was buried. Catherine of Aragon remains at Peterborough. It's now a cathedral. Obviously, the dissolution, it's no longer an abbey. Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard, as I said, are at St. Peter ad Vincula within the Tower of London. And Catherine Parr's tomb, another story about her body and what happens to it. I did a blog for Patreon. So her tomb is at St. Mary's, which is a private chapel at Sudley Castle. And her her funeral was the first Protestant funeral of a king or queen in England. And Jane Grey was her chief mourner. So there you go. There is a look at all of Henry VIII's queens' badges and mottos. I hope you enjoyed that. Which one of, I've kept you for over an hour, but if you're still with me, which one of Henry's wives do you admire the most? I don't like saying favourites because it's like, we don't need to compare them just because there's more than two. But which one do you admire the most? And then I'll let you go. Melissa, did Simon Thurley ever publish on Hever? I have a book from Hever. I don't know that he has published. He might have published academically. I'm not sure. But Hever has a book that I'll dig it out. Maybe I'll pop that into Patreon and some of the stuff that's out of that. Marianne, maybe Elizabeth saw a good example in Anna staying single. Yeah, She had lots of good examples for why to stay single, though, didn't she? But yes, I see where you're going with that. Becky, thank you very much. See you at this evening's HAD. I will mention HAD while Becky reminds me. So History After Dark tonight, 8:15 p.m. Me, Katrina Marchant, I've suddenly pronounced her name differently, and Catherine Ibbotson. We are still on Alfred the Great. So we split Alfred over 2 weeks. He is that great. And so tonight is part two. So you have time to go off and watch part one if you haven't seen that already. Manda, Thomas died at Hever when Elizabeth was six. Do we know what kind of, if they had any kind of relationship? Boleyn. Sorry, I'm catching up there, Manda. Thank you. I asked this of Nicola Tallis in my latest interview with her. So you can check that out, because I think the answer is a basic no, but we do go into that. So I was interviewing Dr. Nicola Tallis about her latest book, Young Elizabeth. That is on my channel if you want to check that out. So there's lots of people admiring Anne of Cleves. Marianne is Catherine Parr. I'm not sure about the outsmarting him. That's the bit I think Anna is given, is that it's attributed to her after the fact. I'm not convinced. I haven't been convinced yet that she had that much of a choice. She played it very well. She played the cards she had very well, but how much she actually had any control, or whether it was, I won't make a problem out of this. I think she was petrified, actually. But she also liked Henry. Not at this point, probably. She hadn't spent much time with him. But they develop a very good relationship to the point where when Catherine Howard is executed, there is potential talk that he will, or in the Cleves camp, that he might remarry Anna. So, I'd love to read more about Anne of Cleves. There's more research being done on her all the time, because she is so fascinating. But I don't think there's too much evidence that she somehow was a brilliant negotiator and knew exactly. That's very much a retrospective view, I think. Melissa admires Catherine of Aragon's Laurie as well. Just wanted the best for her daughter, her husband, and her adopted country. Also, Catherine of Aragon, you know, her mother was a queen in her own right. And I do think that Catherine maybe, you know, saw no reason why Mary couldn't become queen. If Mary's the only legitimate queen, heir, then fine, so be it. Why not? Yes, Laurie, Leonard, Alfred the Great. Ooh, yeah. Oh, yes. Join us for that tonight. Beverly, Anna of Cleves, very smart. After all, she escaped her father's home, but did not have to answer to her husband. Once she is a widow, that is usually the way you get power at this time if you're a woman and independence. But yeah, she certainly seems to have enjoyed life. Diane is a Catherine of Aragon fan as well, because she stood her ground to the end. Yeah, she certainly did, to the detriment of her mental and physical health. Linda's also for Catherine of Aragon. Yes, of course, you miss seeing her tomb. You know what's going to have to happen, Linda. You have to get him to sell one of those cars. Maybe not. Yes, Amanda feels sorry for Catherine Howard. She had no chance. Gareth Russell's biography of Catherine Howard is an absolute must read to understand the complexities, the nuances of the Catherine Howard story, I would say. SJ asks, would Anne of Cleves being socially excluded from remarrying? I think she was legally, like, she couldn't remarry. She would have, I'd have to ask someone who knew more about it than me, because there was, I imagine there were clauses in the annulment agreement. So much of her property, it was the right to lease it, as far as I understand, as opposed to her being given it. So it remained Crown property. She had the right to lease it. Had she have married, that wouldn't have, I imagine that that a lot of that would have gone, and she would be expected to live off her husband's lands. But I don't know. There might be, I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that. I think Henry would have had to approve, Mary Ann says. Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, Edward, Mary. Maybe by that point, she's like, nah, forget it. So let me just remind you, our current book in book club is my well-thumbed copy here, Nicola Tallis's Uncrowned Queen, The Fateful Life of Margaret Beaufort. And our book club is, oh, goodness, I've forgotten already, the 12th of May, I think. It's in between the tours. Yes, 12th of May is our next book club meeting. So you have time to get hold of and read Nicola's excellent book on Uncrowned Queen. And you need this sweater, Melissa. This is one of my favourites. Thank you. So I will leave you all to your day. Hopefully some of you will be joining me again later on, 8:15 p.m. UK time, on History After Dark for the second part of Alfred the Great. Don't think I've got that the right way around, but you know what I mean. Or I will see you next week here at the same time. Take care. Have a great day. All right, everyone. Bye-bye.